Hello there, everybody. It's me, Gary Kidney, the co-host of You've Got to Be Kidding Me on the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network.
And I am Liam Jones, my full name, and I am also a part of the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network as a co-host for You've Got to Be Kidding Me.
We are a TNA history podcast that covers TNA 1 month at a time. We cover all the drama, all the matches, all the Vince Russo nonsense you could ever want in your life.
Have you heard of TNA? I bet you have, but would it be funnier if two people made jokes over it the whole time? Probably.
So if that sounds like fun to you, check it out on this very Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network, and Liam will do bits and whatnot.
This podcast is a member of the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. Visit voicesofwrestling.com to hear the rest of our great podcasts, as well as show reviews, columns, opinions, and updates across the world of wrestling.
Kids, do you like professional wrestling? Oh, we like professional wrestling too. This is Shake Them Ropes, Jeff Hawkins, along with Chris Novembrino. This week, Royal Rumble, Ice Cold Takes, Vengeance, previews, all the news, all the happenings in the world of professional wrestling, and we're on the road to WrestleMania. Chris, how are you?
Hawkins, I have something important to tell you.
Okay.
Today is a milestone day. For your boy Novi.
Groundhog Day.
Because I am currently enjoying a liquid beverage that you can get a dispensary around here. And it's quite potent. Normally edibles don't hit me, and today's the first time they're really hitting me, Hawkins.
What am I supposed to do with that?
You know what you're supposed to do with that? You're supposed to be happy for me for once. You know, I sit here, I work hard to make my life better, and you can't just be happy for me. Trisha knows it.
So I'm here with the chemically addled Chris Novembrino.
Let's talk about wrestling, people.
Just an update on me. I'm currently thawing out. Congratulations to Ron Torbert. The officiating crew and the Kansas City Chiefs. That's all I'm going to say about that. But yeah, we need to start with some sad news. Lanny Poffo passing away earlier today.
Oh.
Poffo made his pro debut in 1974 for the short-lived All-South Wrestling Alliance before heading to NWA's big-time wrestling territory along with his father. Spent the next decade working for promotions such as Portland Championship Wrestling, Continental, International Championship Wrestling, had a short stint in Mid-South before joining WWE in 1985, where we mostly got to know him as Leaping Lanny Poffo, known for reciting poetry and tossing frisbees into the crowd, until he turned heel in 1989 with his genius gimmick, once defeating WWF champion Hulk Hogan via countout on an episode of Saturday Night's Main Event. After that, he signed with WCW in 1995 to take over the Gorgeous George gimmick, which Randy Savage had purchased the rights to, but that never came to fruition. Later on, of course, he had an ill-fated stint giving color commentary in New Japan. I don't know. I remember watching that, and that was absolutely dreadful. But let's remember the good times. Was retired and living in Ecuador. No cause of death as yet, but Lanny Poffo.
Well, he was a clean living one, so I would imagine it's probably like a stroke or something of that
heart
sort.
Heart attack, but I am mostly one of those people who only knows him as frisbee throwing Nipsey Russell clone or the genius, which I'm not a fan of the genius character, to be honest with you. I liked him better as frisbees and poetry, to be honest with you. But you can't deny that he was a pretty good manager for both the Beverly Brothers and I know Mr. Perfect in that run, as annoying as he was. And I would call him, in modern parlance, jobber to the stars, but of course you don't want to use the term jobber, but you know what I mean. Enhancement talent to the stars.
I mean, they never belted the genius.
No, but he was, he was the guy that was like a tier above, your pacey white guys. I mean, he'd get some offense in. Sometimes he'd get beat. Usually if he was in a tag match, his partner would be the one to lose. But
I think the match where he defeats Hulk Hogan by countout is sort of weirdly the match that made this character at the Jobber to the Stars tier.
Oh, on the genius character?
Yeah. Yeah. Huh. Yeah. I have heard that match get cited favorably by people like Cole Cabana in the past. It apparently was a very impactful match or influential match on people in terms of like, oh, look, there is a way to book a lower tier guy to beat the champion in some way.
I always think of him. I mean, I remember watching that match and being a little
where he has the board where he says like Hulk goes down or whatever, or Hulk loses.
Yeah. And count out was applicable because see, he outsmarted Hulk Hogan. So now he's a threat to his title, et cetera. I mean, I never bought it to that.
No, but it's also narratively fitting that like a countout victory would go to the genius's head, that he thinks that because he outsmarted Hulk Hogan, that like the next obvious thing would be that he would be able to pin him somehow.
I would say he's one of the better actors in wrestling, to be honest with you. I think, I mean, his flair for showmanship, whether babyface or heel.
His flair for showmanship, I mean, the rated on homosexual tropes, dude.
Yeah, I know.
That's the thing, is like, it's kind of hard to disconnect his selling from the fact that his selling is entirely premised on, like, dandy tropes.
Yes. I'm not going to deny that.
No, imagine someone trying to.
Well, no, but I mean, at the same time, it's a part of professional wrestling too.
It is a part of professional wrestling, but like, I mean, I think that basically, like, after he left babyface Leaping Lanny Poffo behind, like, I mean, that's when his standard selling ended, and it was all kind of the trope selling from there on out.
Okay.
I mean, like, think about that Hogan Genius match. We get to the atomic drop spots and like the genius is doing like the waving arms thing, and then Hogan's making fun of the waving arms thing. I don't know. Like, I don't think it ages favorably is what I'm trying to say here.
No, I don't think it would. I don't, you know what? They signed him and Honky Tonk Man around the same time, WCW, around that 95, 96 era. Boy, those guys would have died a death in that company.
Oh, yeah.
Either that or you will have gone like Honky Tonk Man beating Dean Malenko in hour one of Nitro.
That era of heels sort of went away. Like the Honky Tonk Man, although the Honky Tonk Man was like a coward more than like a dandy per se.
Right.
But like all those heels sort of went to the wayside once you entered the era of the cool heel in the mid-90s.
Right, and the character heel who couldn't really wrestle kind of went down by the... I mean, and then not that Wayne Ferris couldn't wrestle, but you know what I mean.
Well, it's not that Lanny Poffo couldn't wrestle either, but yeah, like the demands of the style that those guys did in the 80s... Like, I don't, you know,
by the time the mid 90s came around, I mean, and you had ECW and they were starting to, you know, get fans hip to the different styles of wrestling in Japan and Mexico. I mean, lumbering WWF style wrestling where it's like, you know, Greg Valentine can do that for 40 minutes in a match. And
but like, I guess when we're also thinking about Poffo's career, like Poffo, I'm about to say Bobby Eaton, so I want to be really clear that I'm not... There's an obvious difference between the two men, and I'm aware of this. But Poffo's, like, Leaping Lanny Poffo style, I think could have adapted into, like, the WCW first hour demands of the era. Like, the television title and all that sort of thing.
I mean, Poffo was athletic. I mean, he had ups. He could have done it, yeah.
And more so than... the Honky Tonk Man.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah, I mean, like, they essentially already had that covered, too, with Disco Inferno. If you needed, like, guy with hair who danced a lot and couldn't really wrestle, you had him. It's like Discount Honky Tonk Man.
You guys can tag Disco at... No.
Oh, no, Glenn.
Oh, Gilbert. Trust me. No, I'm just saying he's been active on the Twitter snark of late.
Oh, you should find me on Twitter and light me up, baby. Bring it.
Ahead of their quarterly investors call Thursday afternoon, WWE released their reports and touted a company best $1.3 billion in net revenue, an increase of 18% year over year. Their operating income also increased to a record $283.8 million, up 11% year over year. WWE raking in the cash, Chris.
Good for them. I don't know. Like, it's like tough tosses to me. You know.
All
like,
right. No. Well, you know. This is you know.
Great company.
If you were on Twitter, people. I could get some feedback on these stories.
Yeah, and that would have been really deep if you had gotten at me on Twitter.
Oh yeah.
There would have been so much more there.
AEW house shows set to start in March in Troy, Ohio. There will be meet and greets and whatnot. But I find this an interesting strategy. Because it could blow up in their face, or it could be very, very good. Good, you give some of the younger talent some reps, and maybe a main event talent in there. Of late, it's mostly been up to some of the lower tier talents to book themselves in independent shows, et cetera, et cetera. And some have had that drive to do it. Like I know Red Velvet's been doing it of late. I know that, of course, Darby and all the Defy guys like going to Defy. And of course the PWG people like doing that as well. And I, honestly, as a positive note, I do think house shows and meet and greets and trying to get out there into smaller markets and stuff like that. There's a little bit of a populist company of the people vibe to it. I just don't know if it's economically viable for this company to have house shows and not have necessarily, because I think people are thinking they're going to get a Dynamite or a pay-per-view on the road, and you're not. So I mean, it's one of those things where they're not even really selling out Dynamites all that often. They are occasionally, but it's one of those things where I think, man, it's a risk. It's not going to be happening that often. Like they're not going to be doing it every week and or so. It could theoretically run them afoul of some of the independent organizations that they work with. But I see both good and bad in this. What do you think, Chris?
A lot of it is dependent on the economics of this and how big they think these shows need to be. In my mind, these house shows might need to be in the under 500 range. Like you're looking to get like five, you're booking venues that can, you know, have 500 people. You send out one of your main event talents and you have a show mostly comprised of like your undercard guys going up against some local talents. So it's sort of a cost-effective show to book because the local talents are, you know, not nearly as pricey. And you're getting some of your undercard people there working, and you're only having to focus on paying one star to draw there. And you might be able to financially support that and make that make sense. I like the idea of a bit of retail politics here, just going out one person at a time, trying to build the AEW fan base as people who are into wrestling, and like it's kind of like or not even into wrestling, they're into AEW, like
shaking hands and kissing babies.
They like to go and see an AEW show. I think to your point, the danger here is oversaturation, and that is what I'm going to say is really what's going on here with the lack of Dynamite, you know, sellouts as of late. I mean, there've been some, but not enough, as you're suggesting, which says that like you got to be careful about how much you're punching some of these markets then.
Yeah, it's weird because they have a lot of television to fill. They have, you know, they have Dynamite, they have Dark, they have this Ring of Honor show that's going to be coming up soon. They have Rampage and Dynamite and Dark Elevation and Dark. And it feels like it's just they're not using the resources to their benefit. They're just putting product out there. And it's not really building from one show to the other. Although I will admit they did do something at least with Red Velvet this week on, I believe it was Dark Elevation prior to her match with Jade Cargill to build up the fact that she can beat people by submission, et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, they're occasionally doing the little things, but I don't know if the problem is that they're not hitting enough venues. You know, that's the weird thing. And, you know, it's like, okay, am I going to pay to see Anna Jay take on one of the Renegade Twins and in a 15-minute match so that she can learn how to work a 15-minute match? You know, it's one of those things. It's like, okay, how much of a developmental product can you put out there on the road when people really want to see Omega and the Bucks? That's the thing that I'm wondering about.
Yeah, I mean, I think the other thing is that the shows have to be shorter. I think that these house shows have to be like 2-hour events. You know what I mean?
Oh, come on, a 6-hour jam band? And the string cheese incident will come in and play at halftime.
You know, and yeah, they do. Look, the Bucks.
Jade Cargill in a 60-minute Broadway doesn't interest you in any way?
I'll put it this way. I don't think the talents that are on the other side of 35 need to necessarily be like making all these house shows. I think this should be like,
yeah,
if you're
going to
make Jungle Boy a star or Darby Allin a star, or, you know, whoever, a star who's under 30, then you have to start utilizing them that way eventually.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't need a best friends match on it. I mean, I know they know how to work and I know they know how to do their match because I watch it every week on Rampage. So yeah, I would agree there. Jade Cargill, 60-minute Broadway just brought.
Yeah, no, let's give her more time. She's getting closer. Let's let her work this out.
Kota Ibushi is now a free agent, as announced by both Kota and New Japan Pro Wrestling. He is signed to work GCW events here in Los Angeles during WrestleMania weekend. Kind of fitting, in my opinion, because I remember, were you at any of those matches in Dallas where Kota Ibushi was involved?
Yeah, I saw Kota Ibushi at Kaiju Big Battle.
Yeah, Kaiju Big Battle. I was there for, I believe it was the WrestleCon Super Show where he did flips off of a balcony at, what was the name of that venue? That venue was on with the awesome brisket nachos.
Like,
that's all I remember.
Part of his career at some point is going to be a really crazy thing to watch because he's done a lot of really death-defying feats.
A lot of people thinking possibly AEW. Some people just thinking he's going to try and open a school in Japan and just kind of lay low and hit some indie dates here and there.
I'm going to go another direction. I think he opens up a knickknack store.
What is wrong with what?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think he decides that like it's time to do something else because he's Kota Ibushi and he opens up a knickknack store.
Well, he is of a wealthy family, so he could do that if he wanted to.
I mean, he might still do matches, but like he could also do option number three, which like could be anything up to including like working at an aquarium. You tell me.
Right, you need
Ibushi
to stop drinking whatever it is you're drinking.
No, Kota Ibushi would swim with the dolphins. Are you kidding me?
So you think we're going to see Kota Ibushi at SeaWorld, possibly?
You sat next to me, Jeffrey, and watched him wrestle. I believe it was like a doll of some sort, whatever it was. You are telling me that man wouldn't swim with dolphins.
He'd definitely swim with dolphins.
He would definitely swim with dolphins. Is working at an aquarium really that far-fetched? I just want you to think about it.
Moving on.
Right now. No, I want you to think about it later. Reflect on it, okay?
I'm going to try and forget the show as soon as it's done. Raw this week, 2,114,000 viewers. AEW Dynamite, 901,000. NXT, 577,000. Big number for Raw. No football, of course, but also the show after the Royal Rumble. Any quick thoughts on that, or do you want to just go into it?
Yeah, like, I mean, the only thought on Raw is that the closing angle of the Royal Rumble was one of the best pieces of business this company has managed to
come
together in literally years. So if it was under 2 million, I would have been, like, if it was at, like, 1.5, I would have been like, damn, really? Because, I mean, if that didn't get people talking, I don't know that anything could. It's like the patient is dead on the table. So, no, I think this is a good, healthy number and deserved.
And that'll take us into our ice cold thoughts on the Royal Rumble, hitting the lazy river of wrestling criticism. I had an interesting experience watching the Royal Rumble, because I was watching it in Kansas City and my brother watched the first hour with me before we went to dinner. It's funny. I went to dinner when Cody came out as number 30, because I go, well, there's your winner. Came back with number 25 or 26 in the Women's Rumble came out. So I hit all the good parts with Rhea, Asuka, and Liv Morgan. I thought those sequences were pretty fun right there. After getting Nia Jax out. Good God, Nia Jax is back. And then, of course, the main event angle. And my brother hasn't watched wrestling in some odd, 20-some-odd years. He'll still talk about, like, he'll reference 80s wrestlers with his friends and stuff. So I jotted down some notes while watching. Number one, the only two people in the Royal Rumble he knew were Edge and Booker T. Which, of course, you know, connection to the Attitude Era, those would be the only two he expects. He was wondering on the math on Cody Rhodes being Dusty Rhodes' son, because it's like, well, wait a second, is he like 50 or something? No, it's just that Dusty had a kid later in life, which he did not realize. The one guy, I mean, he was impressed with the size of everybody. He's like, my God, everybody's so big in this. I mean, between Drew, Sheamus, Braun Strowman, et cetera. He's like, God, these guys are freaking huge, but can they move and stuff? And I told him no. And you know what? You want to know who the he did like the Sami Zayn angle at the end. He was like, man, that pop was huge. But the guy he was most impressed with, Chris, Logan Paul. He watched Logan Paul in this Rumble. And he knows who Logan Paul is. I mean, my brother's 46, I think it is. He knows who Logan Paul is from social media and stuff like that. But he saw the Buckshot Lariat and he goes, he's really good. Wow, look at that. And then he did the spot with Ricochet, which was, I thought was a fantastic spot.
That was a fantastic.
Nice John Woo type movie type spot. I really did dig that.
No, it was shot really well, too.
They
nailed the coverage on that spot too. Like, I mean,
the shot of him, the shot of Ricochet, and then, and then the wide shot. I mean, that's all they needed to do. And I mean, I know people, you know, they love their technical wrestling and stuff like that, but Logan Paul over the past year and a half, is one of my favorite performers to watch. Cause he always, I mean, look, he has the luxury of doing big things in big spots. But if you're trying
more talent,
and he has the attitude for it. He has the charisma for professional wrestling. My brother was like, my brother came out going, is he going to be a full-time wrestler? Because I think it suits him because he's really good at it. That's what he wants. He wants more Logan Paul, which if you get in the wrestling bubble, and those of us who watch this week after week after week after week, we want fewer celebrities, and we want to concentrate on, you know, technically sound people, et cetera, et cetera. No, people just want the stunt show for the most part. Yeah.
I like Logan Paul. I think, you know, it's the same thing with, like, Pat McAfee. Like, Pat McAfee has been a nice surprise. The thing is, unlike when Lawrence Taylor and Bam Bam Bigelow are colliding or whatever, like, you're having, like guys like McAfee and Logan Paul actually delivering quality. It's not, you know, five-star stuff or anything like that. You know, I don't want to see Logan Paul versus Okada. But these guys actually deliver a much higher value of match than celebs of years past. This is not Dennis Rodman trying to figure out how to wrestle.
But overall, the pay-per-view, I actually found both Rumbles dull. I gotta be honest with you. I mean, they made Gunther look good.
Yeah. But
a lot of the set pieces fell apart quick. You know, the Kofi set piece. It looked like some guys were just trying to call it in the ring at times. The Women's Rumble, really not a lot to talk about in terms of that.
Similarly booked to the Men's Rumble, just like, it, you know, the Iron Person wins, the Iron Heel wins. Like, they were very uninspired bookings.
I thought so, too. That would be a better term for it, uninspired. I mean, your surprises were Booker and, you know, Pat McAfee on commentary.
Okay, yeah, McAfee was funny. He was funny in a lot of different situations.
The Banger Brothers. He kept bringing that up, even though they weren't allowed to.
Yeah, yeah, no, like, and I mean, you. The thing is, it's like he always brings out the bad angel in Michael Cole. It's
yes,
funny.
Yeah. Don't know if Nia Jax is back full time, but that was still.
Oh, we can only hope. And here's what I'm hoping, Jeff. I want to see Nia Jax and Top Dollar. Do like a little bit of an intergender. Yeah, you feel me? You feel me? Maybe she can join Hit Row. And then we can.
Oh, I was thinking the Bloodline, but okay.
Okay. Yeah, I guess. But like, hear me out. Top Dollar, Nia Jax, intergender tag team.
No.
No. Don't do that to me. Okay. All right.
And then, of course, the main event angle, which was tremendous. I mean, even the match with Owens and Reigns was very, very good. But of course, everybody was watching to see Sammy's choice. Sammy hits Roman in the back of the back with a chair. Jey Uso's like, I backed the wrong horse. And now it's on. And that kind of brings me, I'm gonna veer off of the ice cold thoughts. I'll come back to your thoughts if you had any others. Do you?
Oh, no, I want to talk about the Rumble. Or I'm sorry, the main event.
Yeah.
Okay. So like on that, I think the best, I mean, that was an excellent angle. We were sort of already kind of covered that. And I can go into length as to why, but I mean, it, like all the facials and everybody really did a nice job there. I think the cherry on top for me is Jey Uso, because it really brings the whole storyline full circle with like watching Roman toy with Sammy and Kevin reminded him of what Roman did to him and his brother. Like, well,
I think it's gonna pivot to that. I think Roman is now gonna abuse Jey for covering for Sammy.
We're gonna circle back. No, it's gonna go back full circle to the initial main event Jey Uso angle.
Right.
Which I like that. Yeah, they could write this in a simpler way, but I think like for those who have been sort of following this the full way, like Jay's moment was really, really, really earned, and like it was all paved subtly. Like, yeah, like Sammy apologizing to Jey right before it, saying like, I can't betray my brother like that. And that really resonating with Jey too. Like I just think that moment in particular was very strong and was my favorite moment of the whole thing. As for as good as Sammy and Kevin were, the point of Sammy and Kevin was to play in Jey's mind and like the sort of like the tragedy. And this is why I think like it ends tragically, where Jey like ends up still like being loyal to the Bloodline despite all of this. It's just that like Jimmy couldn't see it either. You couldn't see it the same way. Like Jimmy couldn't see what was happening with Kevin and Sammy and what Roman was making Sammy do to Kevin as a grander metaphor for what had happened to them a couple of years back when Roman first put this Bloodline thing together, the initial blood that was spilt in the cage.
I'm going to go to another lazy river point of mine now, because I want to piggyback off of this. AEW has no angles with this kind of emotional resonance or depth or moving parts whatsoever right now.
You couldn't possibly explain an AEW angle like that.
No.
Like
but on the other hand,
with or without a drink.
On the other hand, WWE has decided it can only have one of these angles, because everything else has to be camp or over dramatic garbage or whatever it is.
What do we attribute that to? Is that because Vince is back?
No. I attribute it to WWE style, where it's like the only thing that matters is the main event and everything else can't be. So, it's not serious.
Often for the last several months since McMahon's departure, that like he wasn't fully gone, that he was like a shadow kind of looming in the background.
Yeah, but I think WWE's style is more, hey, we want people to have fun and just make it light and make it, you know.
Well,
and you
I
can't,
guess what I'm saying is, as it stunted the Levesqueification of the company.
I don't know if Levesque has the instincts. I gotta be honest with you. I think Levesque is
who you think was like kind of like doing like kind of like who is giving the final say so on the booking patterns right now?
Levesque.
Okay.
But we get to this Bailey Becky interaction on Raw. And I hated this Raw. I hate a lot about this Raw. I thought Cody Rhodes had a very good promo, but other than that, wasn't a lot that I liked on this Raw. But this Becky Bailey promo made me furious. Because there is a story there with depth that they could be telling right now. Very, very easily. That Bailey has felt as a part of the, you know, one of the horsewomen to do this entire, you know, get this entire Divas division, you know, into women's wrestling and stuff like that, that she's been passed over a bit. And she's had to go heel to be taken seriously on the main roster. And then she decided to recruit a couple of people who have also been overlooked on NXT and come up to help, you know, to help change things, etc. Becky's coming out with this unserious man character where she has to play Stone Cold the entire time as opposed to having any emotional connection to her words. And then Bailey brings up the whole, the only reason Seth Rollins is your husband is because he knocked you up. And we're failing the Bechdel test. The Bechdel test being, you know, you can't have, if you have a scene with two women.
Also, like, yeah, right. There's that.
They have to talk about a man in some ways. Where all Becky had to do was look at Bailey and go, what happened to my friend? And you know, and hey, I got to do a main event with Ronda, sure, et cetera, but that never stopped you from being a star and all these things. And really just kind of having a moment. And instead we're getting the cackling Aunt Pam dressing weirder and weirder by the week, spouting off dumb, cheap heat lines to Becky. And I'm like, this is the problem in both companies' women's divisions, is that none of these women have any depth whatsoever. And you can at least see in WWE that they have the potential to be able to do an angle with some depth and moving parts in it. It just, it, I was like, and neither of these women right now look to be in the main event picture for WrestleMania, which is also interesting in its own right for many, many reasons. But, now, did you have the same sour taste in your mouth as I did when watching this?
Okay, so circling back to the Bechdel thing, it just arrived into my mind that the problem with that is beyond just the Bechdel thing. It's that this, the man character is not good. It requires constant overperformance from Becky Lynch.
Yes.
All the time. But to have it spotlighted in the most essential way that Becky is a woman deeply undercuts the character kind of to the core.
A little bit, yeah.
But, yeah, you call yourself the man, and yet, it was a very, very bad piece of business, and I have gotten very sour on Becky Lynch's the man character. It's only done in bold colors. It is like bold neon green, bold neon orange, bold neon yellow. It is never, there's no room for any subtlety.
Come on out here, you dope. I'm going to tell you about, you know, it's like,
Becky has to like swing her hips and like kick her legs. Remember when she first started wrestling and she was doing the Irish last thing and was doing like the jiggy kicks? Like she would do like a jig and then she'd kick him. It's like that level of overperformance only done like in a Stone Cold character.
Yes, I agree.
And I hate it. It's like really, it's become deeply grating to me, whether babyface or heel. It's just starting to get go away heat. I like her, but I hate this the man character. It's not empowering. It's gone so far. It's delusional. It comes off as delusional more than an empowered sort of thing.
Yeah. And that's actually my big issue, is it's a delusional character versus a tough character.
Right.
Yeah.
This is not a strong character. Like the way she says it, it sounds loony.
Want to head over and do a preview of NXT Vengeance Day?
Yeah. No, oh man. This is certainly one of the many NXT live network events that you'll be able to view on Peacock during the year. And I cannot say much more.
This is indeed, as they say, a show. Starting with Apollo Crews versus Carmelo Hayes with Trick Williams, 2 out of 3 falls match. Is there any other ending other than Trick Williams helping Apollo Crews or Trick Williams helping Carmella Hayes get that third fall?
I think, you know, the other ending would be Trick Williams cost Carmelo, and this is the
and that's a split.
It's a separation of Carmelo from Trick. Yeah.
All right. I'll allow for that.
I'm not saying that's the most likely outcome. You're asking me, is there any other one? Like that, yeah. That's certainly a pathway here. Like you could heat Apollo up for, like, what's the mid card title or whatever.
The NXT North American title.
The North American title. Yeah, sure.
Well, Carmelo held that before.
No, I'm saying Apollo.
Oh, Apollo, yeah. I mean, yeah, Apollo's going to be a little bit lost after this, I think, trying to figure out who to heat him up for.
Maybe he could join the Schism.
In the hobby, it's not easy being a fan of ripping packs or repacks. We hype ourselves up thinking, maybe I can pull a Ken Griffey Jr. rookie card, but with zero transparency on available cards and hit rates, it's all just a shot in the dark. Until now. Introducing Slab Packs from ArenaClub.com, the only repack that provides real value, a complete view of all possible cards, and clear hit rates for each one. Now, when I buy Slab Packs at Arena Club, it finally feels like I know what I'm getting. I was able to open an Arena Club Slab Pack, and I'll be honest, it was a lot better than what you normally do. Say you go to a card show, and there's a random innocuous brown bag of cards, and yeah, you can open it and look, it's gonna be junk. You know what I mean? Like, you know what you're probably gonna get in those. Maybe you find that fun, and sometimes I do. Sometimes I like just opening up cards and saying, hey, look at some random cards or whatever. But if you're really in this game to find value and find particular cards, it sucks to have to buy these mystery packs, and it ends up being, you know, almost nothing. You know, nothing of value. Not with Arena Club. You can display, again, of all available cards, hit rates, grading. So you know that when you're opening up the slab pack, you are going to get something valuable. You are getting something good. And Arena Club, in addition to having those great slab packs we just talked about, is also a marketplace for card collecting, buying, trading, selling, displaying, all that sort of stuff. But those Arena Club slab packs, man, they are revolutionizing the repack game with transparency. After your pulls are revealed, they'll immediately be placed in your vault for safekeeping or trading and selling, and you can have them officially graded by Arena Club as well. So again, setting these things off, it's going to be officially graded by Arena Club. And the Arena Club grading process is accurate, fast, and transparent, with full grade rationale provided and explanation of how your card was scored. So whether you're buying, selling, trading, or displaying, Arena Club is the card collecting platform that you have to check out. So right now, I've got a special offer here for Voices of Wrestling Network listeners. You can get 10% off of your first purchase by going to arenaclub.com/VOWnet. Again, that's arenaclub.com/VOWnet. Now, that's a crazy offer. That's 10% off a $400 slab pack. $40 off right there. 10% off your first purchase. No matter what that purchase is, 10% off. Again, that's arenaclub.com/VOWnet, arenaclub.com/VOWnet for 10% off your first purchase on Arena Club. And we thank them for sponsoring the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network. What's going on, guys? This is Rich from the Flagship Podcast here on the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network. If I could have a moment of your time, I'd like to tell you about one of our sponsors, Eufy Video Lock. Eufy Video Lock is a smart lock, a 2K camera, and a doorbell, all 3-in-1, offering you triple security. So you can have everything in one device rather than installing many pieces on your front door. But it's not just for security. The Eufy Video Lock is also for convenience. No more concerns about losing keys, and you can assign passwords to your family members and see them coming back home via the integrated cameras. Some other great features we love about the Eufy Video Lock is it is easy to install and set up with just a Phillips screwdriver, no drilling required. Keyless entry, no more fumbling for keys when your hands are full. You never have to worry about kids losing keys or passing among renters. You also have 0.3 second fingerprint recognition, and 1 second unlocking. Again, 0.3 seconds, it's going to recognize your fingerprints, and in 1 second, it's going to unlock. And with the AI self-learning chip embedded, the more you use it, the more accurate it will be. Also, no battery anxiety. You have a rechargeable battery in there that could last around 4 months, and you will get a low battery notification before it runs out. Passcode unlocking, a remote control with a 2K clear sight, see who's at your door, and control from anywhere through the Eufy app. With enhanced night vision, you can have optimized view even in the evening. You can also secure your package delivery by view and two-way audio. And then best of all, no monthly fee. A bunch of other brands out there are going to charge you a monthly fee. You have your recordings locally, and you never have to pay for storage. Customer service, Eufy's got you handled as well. They're on standby for you 24/7, so you can enjoy a worry-free experience with an 18-month warranty, all backed by their professional customer service team. Contact them anytime by telephone, email, or live chat. Personally, as a homeowner, I love my Eufy video lock. I have the ability to see what's going on when I'm not home, when packages has arrived, and really the thing I love the most about it, the ease of being able to lock and unlock my doors without having to fumble with my keys and reach in my pocket or wait, no, crap, they're in my backpack, all that sort of stuff. All this is happening while my dogs are barking at me. You know what? Not anymore with the Eufy video lock. I touch it. 0.3 second fingerprint recognition. 1 second, door is unlocked. Much, much easier. So if you want to jump on board with Eufy Video Lock, search Eufy Video Lock. That is E-U-F-Y Video Lock. Again, that's Eufy Video Lock, E-U-F-Y Video Lock, or visit eufyofficial.com/videolock to see how you can gain complete control of your door.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
I hate that crew so much. And I love the Grizzled Young Veterans, and I love Joe Gacy.
Yeah, it's amazing. Like, I actually like all three of them, and yet they just...
I love the parts. I hate the ensemble.
So bad together. Yeah, it's like, it's like three really good musicians that you like coming together and just making the shittiest band.
And Yoko Ono, the Rock's daughter.
Yeah. Bringing in Yoko on Vox.
For the tag team women's tag championship of NXT, Katana Chance and Caden Carter, your champions, versus Pornhub Presents Fallon Henley and Kiana James, with Josh Briggs and Brooks Jensen and probably G, the Brazilian secretary.
And Zach, potentially, whoever Zach is.
Yes, Zach. It's probably going to be the brother of some kind, but
right,
yeah,
it's gonna be her brother. Yeah,
it's gonna be her brother. It has to be. But do the unlikely pairing of country bar owner who refuses every bit of help to keep the bar afloat, and Horn Incorporated with his title?
I don't even know anymore.
I don't know.
What is the off ramp to this story? I know. Like, I can't. This story
does the
like,
virgin lose his cherry after this match?
There's so many. There are a lot of moving pieces, but like none of them are connected. They're just like loose pieces spinning in space.
You know, Chase and Carter will do their little dance on the way to the ring. And see, here's the thing: is I actually kind of am starting to enjoy Kiana James's wrestling because she's an absolute
not bad
brick crap house.
Yeah,
you know, compared to some of these other women. Like, yeah, I'll be interested in this, but God, they're going to give them the belts. They're going to give them the belts for some reason. And then we're going to just move on with this terrible, terrible story.
That would be the worst thing for Carter and Chance. I feel like they do lose here, and that we're heading to the off ramp of this story, whatever the hell that's supposed to be.
Wes Lee versus Dijak for the NXT North American title. And Dijak continues to just do a voice from an 80s action movie villain.
Mr. Lee, sir.
Poor Wesley has not been the same since they fired his tag team partner. Poor kind of treading water here, in my opinion, even though he's very, very talented.
Dijak hasn't been the same since Keith Lee has been gone.
That's true, too. And he's actually become less likable, even though I like the look.
Better. Character is somehow worse.
Yes, looks better. Character stinks. That's the problem here. Does Dijak get the title here?
No.
I agree. I think Wesley keeps this.
Yeah.
And we figure out a super match for him somewhere else. In what is kind of an interesting match.
You make of the backstage promo with Von Wagner and Robert Stone? That was like hilarious. Did you see this?
I did.
After all these years, Von, I still don't know who you are, which is like the funniest way for the writing to tell it itself that they've done jack shit.
You know what that is?
Have no characters, Vaughn. I don't know what I'm doing.
That's the improv show where 5 minutes into the scene, one guy looks at the other and goes, "Who are we?" to each other.
It was such a meta moment of like, yes, this is what is wrong with WWE's product in a nutshell.
Why are we in this scene together right now, Vaughn? What are the writers going to do?
No idea what they do with one another.
I wanted Von Wagner at that moment to pull a She-Hulk from the Disney series and leap out of the script for NXT and find a want somewhere on the WWE network where we could figure out why the hell Von Wagner and Robert Stone are together, because they have no idea why they're in the same scene.
It says here you're supposed to be some sort of parody of Tony Khan, the AEW CEO. I, very slowly, and that is my character.
Oh, goodness. The New Day, Kofi Kingston and Xavier Woods defending their NXT Tag Team Championships versus Gallus, Mark Coffey and Wolfgang, Pretty Deadly, Elton Prince and Kit Wilson, and Chase University, Andre Chase and Duke Hudson, with the always, always game Thea Hale, who is insane. Do the New Day keep the titles, or do they use this as an excuse to get the New Day back on the main roster?
I mean, you got to think the New Day are going to be back on the main roster before WrestleMania. So I think this might be the end of it. But obviously, I don't think the New Day are going to lose their title. I think they're going to have like a gripe, that sort of thing.
Okay, who takes it from them?
Maybe Pretty Deadly gets it back after all of this anyways.
I am under the impression that Pretty Deadly's head to the main roster after.
So then it would be Gallus at that point.
Oh, do you? I think Chase University has a chance here to see what the payoff on this Duke Hudson, Andre Chase story is, where they eventually lose it to, I don't know, Briggs and Jensen. Because, I don't know, Duke Hudson wants to sleep with the secretary or something.
Yeah, well, that Briggs and Jensen cast is pretty large. You got a lot of moving parts.
I don't know. I think the New Day, they've done their stint in the minors.
I'm going Gallus.
Gallus isn't a bad team to do it. I think Gallus could use it.
Yeah, I think so too.
I do like the Coffey Brothers and Wolfgang. I don't know why. Maybe it's just all the UK that I've been watching. For the NXT Women's Championship, a triple threat match between Roxanne Perez, a definitively improved on promos Gigi Dolin, and of course the always solid JC Jane. Is there any ending other than Gigi Dolin and JC Jane bickering and Roxanne stealing a pin?
Yeah, I don't think so. You have to just suspend your brain to make this story make a lot of sense. Cause it's sort of like, why wouldn't one of them just pin the other? Like, really?
Oh, I assume that's going to be a spot in the match.
That'll be a spot, the early deception spot. But like, You know, I don't know. I this is a silly match. I'm not really sure why they booked themselves into this angle. You should have done it with Dolan, or you should have done it with Jane.
Secondary question. Did Roxanne Perez get enough in the Royal Rumble? She was out of there pretty quick to quote unquote protect her, but I don't buy
it. Yeah. Yeah. I if you're going to bring her up to the main roster.
I don't think they're going to. I think it was just one of those, hey, we need to fill this out. We put some NXT people in there.
I don't know. I mean, I don't think the Rumble is as much of a prestige builder.
I agree.
Yeah, so I don't know that it matters.
And then finally, for your NXT championship in a steel cage, Bron Breakker versus Grayson Waller. Who you got?
Really? I'm going to say Waller wins.
Huh. Okay.
I think
it's a more interesting choice. I think we've seen what Braun can do, but
he's looked so weak throughout this feud, right? Yes. He's really been booked to look like the underdog. Like, he has no business beating Breakker. And especially after that countout loss, I think he finds a way to suck it out. If there's an escape option from the steel cage, right?
I think so. I think it's a WWE steel cage.
Yeah, if there's an escape, I would say Grayson Waller wins it.
Okay, you've talked me into the he does something to Braun to keep him in the cage and then climbs out type thing.
Yep.
Yeah, that feels right. So that he doesn't get a strong win as a champion.
This also protects Braun Breakker. Yes.
Yeah. No, I think you're right there. That'll do it for previews and reviews. Now on to the rest of the Lazy River. Chris, you're up.
Okay, so we are now 50 matches into the aspirational title reign of Jade Cargill, in which we hope that she becomes a good long-form wrestler. And let me tell you, after watching AEW Dynamite with Red Velvet and Jade Cargill, we are going to have to keep dreaming on, people, because it is not going to happen. This match, every single spot, up to and including the ambitious, and yes, ultimately pulled off in a way that did not hurt Red Velvet, Jaded at the end. Every single spot was clunky. The timing was bad on it. Form on every single thing did not look crisp. And the booking around this entire match was really silly. Is Jade Cargill a babyface or a heel?
Is Red Velvet a babyface or a heel?
Right. And the way, theoretically, I guess the way I would read the opening to that match is that Red Velvet, having been like someone Jade Cargill has defeated in the past, and then Red Velvet became loyal to Jade Cargill, and then in the end, Jade Cargill still kicked her out of the baddies. How do you really morally assess the if you can't beat them, join them approach of Red Velvet? I don't know. That's an interesting question for the philosophers. But let's put that aside. Like, we get to this moment where Red Velvet attacks Jade Cargill from behind. And Jade Cargill has been booked so in between. Because, like, she's got the kid out there. And, you know, she, like, looks like a champion, so theoretically those things, like, sort of play to a baby face. And then everything else about her is pretty much unlikable as a character. And her offense is always, like, bullying and, like, dominating and that sort of thing, and, like, classic sort of heel offense. She doesn't sell or anything. Red Velvet attacks Jade Cargill from behind, and the crowd doesn't know what to do with it. Like, this should be this... If this match is supposed to be hot, this is the 50th match in Jade Cargill's title reign. We need to believe that Jade Cargill is in peril of losing this belt, which means the only way this spot really works to jump the match off hot is if Red Velvet attacks Jade Cargill and the crowd's like, oh yeah, cool, I want to see Jade Cargill lose. Like, this is like reverse Goldberg. Like, she's on a streak and we don't want to see her on this streak.
Well, here's the other problem before you go back to it. We never made Red Velvet likable again.
Nope.
After this turn.
Nope.
I mean, how could you
like her for what she did in the first place?
Yes.
It's exactly noble that she joined up with Jade Cargill.
And she's coming out, she's doing some of the baby face, you know, smiling and winking and things like that. And she's very charismatic at that. But at the same time, she's also yelling things. And you're just like, what are you? She needed to have a come to Jesus promo last week to set, or on Friday to set up this match. And it's just one of those things where it's like none of these baddies have a clear, I mean, you want to talk shades of gray. They are a little... They're all literally shades of Layla Gray.
Yeah. No, so, just... like, here's the story, right? Like, I'm going to give you what the story should be here. That what Jade Cargill has been doing over these last 50 matches is she has been creating a thrall around women who are weaker in the division. And they sort of all kind of fall under the spell, the bullying spell of Jade Cargill. And Red Velvet herself was also a victim of this. And she's finally seen the error of her ways. And she wants to beat Jade Cargill once and for all to show that, like, she's not like some like unbeatable like giant tyrant that we all have to be scared of. Layla,
yes, Chira.
Like, I can do this, I can beat them, and when once I beat her, you'll see, you don't need to follow her, you can do your own thing. Like, I'm doing it for the people, basically. I'm doing it for all of us. There's something that like could actually get people behind essentially wanting, quote unquote, the baddies to be free of the evil minion. Like, and I, to that point, what Jade Cargill needs to be doing is bullying people like Hogan and Gray a lot more. Like, the presentation of Gray relative to Cargill in this match was totally wrong. Like, Cargill needs to constantly be belittling Gray.
Yeah.
And she needs to be belittled, like the baddies, like, they're supposed to be out there looking good in them backstage. Like, basically Cargill should be berating them for not looking good enough or like not doing a good enough job supporting her. You know, like right. It should always be this thing where like, we don't like the way she talks to them. And Red Velvet's finally standing up for her. That would be something that creates a clear babyface heel dynamic, which makes for an intriguing match. Otherwise, this is a foregone conclusion. Red Velvet's not been booked in a way. She has no wins coming into this that suggests she's hot enough to go up against Jay Cargill. And like in this, the course of this match, because Cargill doesn't sell like that for anyone ever, she never looks like she's really in big enough trouble to Red Velvet. And like, keeping it real, Red Velvet's not quite there to deliver the giant heel in peril sort of, like, it's not quite there. Not, like, this match for me, like, now we're 50 matches into the Jay Cargill experiment. It's not very good. And, you know, the Cannies of the world said, let's just see how this plays out. And it has played out, people.
You brought Canny back for the show. Oh,
yes, I did. Well, I came all the way to New Mexico for this. Yeah, well, you get a t-shirt, too. Get out of here. We're at the, you know, verdict point here, people. We've seen 50 matches of it. It is what it is, people.
I am going to put over a match you should watch from this week. The main event of Rampage, Emi Sakura versus Jamie Hayter. This match ruled. They got rid of a lot of the Freddie Mercury-isms of Emi Sakura. She's still wearing the Queen getup, and she still has a couple of people in her court, but there's none of the there's no Queen soundtrack. There's no We Will Rock You thing with the chop. She and Jamie went in there and chopped the crap out of each other. And Emi Sakura, once again, at age 46, is doing the Terry Funk middle age crazy thing, almost as good as Terry Funk did, doing, you know, doing moonsaults off the top rope and just being a badass in the ring. And Jamie Hayter,
Satomura, they're very inspiring, aren't they?
Oh yeah, no, and Jamie was giving her just as good. I mean, they were both in pain from the chops because they had welts all over themselves from them. This match banged, Chris. I was like, this is what I wanted out of Emi Sakura after watching all these squashes on Dark and Dark Elevation, is to give her some credibility as a badass. And Jamie Hayter was up to the task too, and these two women threw themselves at one another to just have a great match. I actually adored it. Your turn.
Let me ask you this. Did you really care, other than the Becky and Bayley thing, like, was there anything on Raw that captured your attention?
Rhea calling out Charlotte was an interesting pivot, because the rumor was it was gonna be Bianca and Charlotte the entire time. And so now we're going back to that.
I wasn't as surprised by that. So for me, like, other, like, I thought the Cody promo was good.
Cody promo was very good, I thought.
Nice summary. It was very Cody. Exactly.
Like, all the Cody-isms. So what do you want to talk about? You know, that kind of thing. I mean, he has his gimmick.
Let me shoot with you, brother. It's really every time he's shooting with us and really taking us, you know, down memory lane. And it, like, look, I think it's good. Cody Mania is going to be a perfectly fine storyline.
I love Kana, the Kana character, and I loved I loved creepy PTA clown mom in the Carmella thing where Asuka just shows up. I don't know what this character is supposed to be, but she looks like, again, creepy clown PTA mom. That's what she was going for, and I'm kind of here for it. I'm kind of here for the ascent of Asuka if we're going to give her the chamber win.
Yeah, I like that. I look, the repackage of Asuka has been done fairly, you know, like, very strong so far. Out of 10, I'd say, like, it's a solid 7 or 8 out of 10 sort of, like, reheating, restrengthening package. Like, you know.
So to circle back then, do you think that Charlotte's the babyface in the Rhea feud?
Can Charlotte remain the babyface?
How does she not get booed?
Right, no. Inevitably, this pivots to, actually, we've seen Charlotte win, and, like, she clearly the company likes her. And Rhea has not been, this is the mistake routinely is making. I think you might have to do a double turn.
You flip them.
Yeah.
But
Judgment Day face after the chamber or something like that.
Well, it might be escalated by the fact that Dominic Mysterio, I adored him in the Cody promo coming out. I should have been the second generation royal family.
He's funny. He's good now. This character is very entertaining.
Yes, it's frightening. And I thought the Cody Balor match was solid.
Yeah, that was a great road to WrestleMania sort of match for the contender. No, like Balor was the perfect first opponent.
No interest in this men's elimination chamber whatsoever because the stakes aren't high enough. The North American title is stupid. And Austin Theory holding this title, like that entire MVP lounge was crap. It was absolute garbage.
Like, his character stinks. He's not adding anything ever.
Yeah, and again, we said Grayson Waller is a better Austin Theory at this point than Austin Theory.
Yeah. And I think that will only be borne out as we continue along the road to WrestleMania here. Austin Theory stinks.
I would like to praise another act, Chris.
Okay.
On this lazy river. Both on, I believe, Dark and also on Dynamite. The Outrunners of Truth Magnum and Turbo Floyd. I've mentioned them before. These guys look like the Rock and Roll RPMs and the Fabulous Ones had a baby. Their work in the acclaimed squash on Dynamite had me in stitches from their scissoring and stuff. They are just pure gimmick. And I need them signed, and I need them to do a couple of 80s training montages. I need them to do all the 80s territory stuff just for my own personal amusement. That's what I want. And I want a best of 31 versus FTR between these two teams because they're a very good team as well.
Is this Billy Gunn and his son's thing a big swerve to get the belts off of the Acclaimed?
I think so. I think it's going to be disappointing.
This is the betrayal of Billy Gunn. Like, Daddy Ass betrays them yet again.
We just went through this, though.
I know. That's like, I mean, I guess maybe you could have the Guns betray their father and like beat down their father and beat down the Acclaimed. Like, I guess you could do it that way and keep the act together. But this has been very, very circular. And whatever this is, I want it to be the end of the road between the Guns and the Acclaimed.
There's a possibility they set up another feud. Yuka Sakazaki was offered a spot in the Dark Order on Dark this week, or Dark Elevation, I can't remember which one. If that leads to Yuka and Maki Ito in a feud, I'm kind of here for that, to be honest with you, because I love Yuka Sakazaki. She was adorable in this entire angle.
Yeah, yeah, it was... Don't worry about it.
Oh, okay. I won't worry about that. Let me give one quick hit again. And before that, I thought Excalibur absolutely ruined the Thatcher, Daniel or Bryan Danielson match by basically saying Timothy Thatcher doesn't care about MJF's money. He's just here for the competition. And I'm like, no, he was hired to break his arm. And I'm not a fan
of this arm storyline. It's getting lost in it.
But you don't have an Arn Anderson in there who's in there just trying to hurt a guy. You have Tim Thatcher making his mean faces and kind of doing a little bit of grappling with it. But, you know, you don't have the killers that you think you'd have in here. And I agree. It's one of those things where it's like MJF goes in, berates a heel. Heel goes in and has a good match with Bryan Danielson. I'm like, I don't want good matches. I want a beatdown of some kind here.
Yeah, I just thought that Thatcher's motivations here needed to be clearer. I hated that so quickly after Thatcher loses, we already go to Roosh. I think there needed to be a scene in between here where MJF goes up to Thatcher and treats Thatcher like a piece of crap.
Oh, like, really?
Yeah. Okay. No. I know some people want like Thatcher to be like MJF's like, you know, new hired gun or whatever. I think if what we need to show with MJF is that he uses people.
Okay.
That when you fail him, you get punished. That failure means punishment.
Oh, okay. That'd be an interesting wrinkle, because you're right. There are no, I mean, and there weren't for the five tests of Jericho either. There was no payoff for failing, really. It was just, I'm bringing in these guys type of a thing.
And that gives you options with Thatcher, too. It makes what you want to do with Thatcher the next time around more open-ended as well. But, like, I think the big missing piece of the puzzle with MJF has been menace and, like, unlikability. If anything, right now, MJF's bringing us great wrestlers every week, and they're having great matches. Who doesn't like that? That's neat. No, what we need is, if you feel that way, if that's your vibe, baby, then what needs to happen is MJF needs to hurt your great wrestlers afterwards, and you need to hate him for it. He uses them. He's such a piece of crap. You need to, like, not like this guy.
I like this idea, because you're absolutely correct. What's happening is, Bryan Danielson gets to have great matches with these guys who are supposed to be pieces of crap who are being hired to hurt him. And you need to get back to the fact that, yeah, oh, it was a very good match. No, I want people to hate MJF, and I want to be excited for this match coming up type of thing. No, I think you got something there.
He's a dream match promoter.
Yes, pretty much.
Thank you.
It's a Bryan Danielson vanity project or something. It's like, okay, whatever. You're up.
All right, what have we not touched on AEW other than the main event here between
Darby
and Samoa Joe?
I think that is, because that's my last point in my rundown that I have. So let's
then go for it, my man.
I liked a lot about this match. In fact, it was the only thing I really liked on Dynamite other than like the backstage view, because look, I like the Takeshita match. It was fine. I mean, they were all well worked story. And I kind of like, you know, Moxley and Paige wasn't bad. It was just one of those things where I was like, I thought they ran it back too quick. And I wanted to see a fight where a wrestling match broke out type of a thing because of the angle. But I loved Darby coming out in the jacket of thumbtacks. My problem
the visual
is,
of the jacket of thumbtacks was excellent.
Yes, my problem is they didn't tell the story that they needed to tell with Darby Allin. And this belt and this reign did not elevate him in any ways. They did it almost for the cheap pop in Seattle, and they moved on, which is driving me nuts, because there was a story here to tell, especially with him taking the title to Japan and having these banger after banger matches. I know Taz hates hearing that, but it's the truth. While he was defending him. And that is that Darby's style is wearing down on him, and eventually he's going to get caught. Now, they said it in passing on the commentary. I am well aware of that. But they didn't tell us the story. And in essence, the story that they did tell is that Darby Allin, whose reckless abandon was there, decided he just wanted to do a vanity spot where he spent 5 minutes tearing apart the ring, and he got beat because he was an idiot. That's the story they told. And you're just like, well, okay, if Darby is one of your pillars, if Darby is a guy that you want to build the foundation of your company on,
he needs to be beating Samoa Joe in feuds.
He needs to
I'm
be
sorry.
Beating Samoa Joe for this title and to continue to build this
title. What's Samoa Joe, 45, 46?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. No, Darby Allin needs to be beating Samoa Joe.
And instead, we're just going back to Wardlow and Samoa Joe. Going back to that well again, probably to run Hobbs in another three-way between the three of them. So we're just going to have a repeat of that feud. That's just what it feels like.
Yeah, but you know, Jeff, at least they're having great matches.
Yeah.
It's
long-term storytelling. Yeah.
Right. It's not enough to keep me warm at night. No, like that. That's the thing is it's like, okay, yes, this was actually a very good match. And if you like, you know, look at the aggregate of the matches they had, all good. Was the story any good? Did it elevate Darby Allin? No. And then, like, is it going to any place you're really interested in? Oh, it's Samoa Joe and Wardlow again. Can't wait. Bring it to me, baby. Get me there.
And another heatless feud, probably, up until, we'll have a couple of back and forths where Wardlow destroys some security geeks. And then we'll have the mean guy match at the pay-per-view. But
nice matches in service of meh storylines.
Yes,
is being generous.
Yes, and that's my problem. Is I have this argument over at Fight Game because those users are like, I just want to see great wrestling. And Gran Akuma, who I talked to as well, he's like, I'd rather be a fan of the company with the great matches versus the great acting. And I get the points, but wrestling when it becomes popular isn't popular because of the great matches. It's popular because of violence, and it's popular because of the heat that the feuds are building. You know, people copy the promos. People copy, you know, the beatdowns. People copy the angles. You know what they don't copy? Like they don't copy, you know, suplex. I mean, they do, but I mean, they don't. Nobody's going to say, hey, you want to go out and play and do Hangman versus Omega?
Right, because that, like, you also can't, you know, do that in your backyard too, but like I think of like WCW Nitro 96 formula, like on the best episodes, as sort of being the template. Right, the first hour is mostly good matches, and the second hour is the big angles that really sort of capture the attention and capture the imagination. And like that, it's still the top of the card is the story stuff. If you don't have like a good hot main story that, you know, is coherent, and initially the NWO was sort of a coherent storyline, it stopped being at one point, and that's when the show started getting bad.
Yeah, and I mean, in terms of coherent storylines, let's take a look at some of them. I mean, the women right now, Ruby goes in there, gets blown off by Britt. But then again, Ruby's opening line was, "You good?" As if that's caring or anything. And it's all revolved around
Ruby texts sup to people on
sup,
a regular.
Yes.
Yeah.
And this whole thing is revolving around, you know, a company that didn't want half of these performers anymore, and people wanting to form cliques based on their association with a company that mistreated them. And you have Britt, who is the eternal heel, but is getting cheers, so she's actually the babyface here. And it's more of that baddies, unclear motivation type thing. I don't buy the homegrown versus outsider gimmick at all, because I don't think it helps the division any, and it won't help the people who lose this feud. So, I mean, you have MJF and Bryan Danielson. That story is fairly clear. But the tag team story is retracing footprints again.
The Danielson, they're all repetitive, right? Like, that's the big issue. I guess you could say the WWF versus AEW, like little mini WCW versus NWO feud is intriguing. I don't know. Ruby Roja is like the Sting character. Is this really like super exciting? But boy,
is she gonna be coming from the roof now?
Yes. No, that's totally what I want to have happen. She needs to get like Lex Luger.
You know what a great idea is? We could have Ruby Soho leave for a year.
Oh, no. She like disappears for a month and then, yeah, she reappears from the roster. Like, this has to be done like Community Theater NWO. That's exactly what that bad angle is. And then you have. And then you have the main event angle, which, yeah, like, okay, it's coherent. MJF is injuring Danielson, so that Danielson goes into the Iron Man match, not 100%, so that at the end, you know, like, he can't be Iron, right? But, like, it's really repetitive. And that's also the same thing that happened here with Darby Allin and Samoa Joe for the TV title and whatever other title was on the line at various points here. And now he's circling back to Wardlow. Like, there's just this, like, repetitive nature to AEW booking, and it just doesn't forgive away, like, sort of, like good matches can't forgive that away for me. I'm not excited to see the next story because
I'm not, you know, a well choreographed match where everybody's really smooth. It just doesn't get me off as a wrestling fan. I'm sorry. I know that's weird. I like the heat. I like feeling like the two guys in the ring hate each other. You know, those are the things that get me. That's why I don't think that Jay Briscoe so much.
Beat MJF, right? Like at the end of all of this, I just still don't think that Danielson can beat MJF. They have gotten so lost in the arm injury angle because they started it so early. Like, we still have, like, what, 3 weeks before that match? Is it three or four?
I think we're on week four of this.
No.
It happened during the Bandito.
How many more weeks until the match between
MJF? He has to win all his matches through February 8th. So next week is the last match he has to win.
Okay, so and that's Rouge?
Yes.
Like that's weird. And then if he did that, then they'd be having the match in March.
Yes, and what's going to happen is
you have Danielson get the arm injured in the last match before like the so like he wins the qualifying match, right? Like the much more coherent like pattern with this would be Danielson is running through all of these guys. Like MJF keeps getting like these assassins and Danielson's just like mauling them. And you're like, oh shit, like Danielson hasn't looked this dominant since 2013. And he gets to that last match before the qualifying match. MJF is like furious that all these people are failing him. He sends in Thatcher because like these guys are, you know, like just, like he at least thinks that Thatcher can do some damage and maybe is his best last chance of defense. And then Thatcher does manage to injure Danielson's arm. Like you can even have, if you want to protect Thatcher, you can have some sort of deal where like MJF says to Thatcher, like, I want you to hurt something. I want you to break something on it. And Thatcher does manage to pull that off, but Danielson still manages to prevail. And then you have 3 weeks of injured Danielson going into MJF. This is so much cleaner than what we've had here where like Danielson's arm's been injured, but like Thatcher should have been like the guy who like made it hanging on by a thread.
Here's my fear. My fear is the story they're going to tell is this. Danielson wins all his matches going into the pay-per-view.
Right.
MJF loses the title eliminator next week versus Takeshita. And so what we get is, see, I won all my matches. You lost yours. You're not a real wrestler.
Oh, it's WWE momentum. You could also, like this is essentially a momentum feud. Not enough. It's in the ironically, the story here is in the matches. For all these people who talk about they have a great match all the time. Like the story here is supposed to be the Danielson in these great matches is dominating these great opponents in a great way. Like this should be flashback to 2013, baby. WrestleMania all over again.
Yeah, he should have murdered Timothy Thatcher.
Yeah. No, he should have been murdered, I think. Ever. Like, Cage, come on.
Yeah, I agree.
Cage should have been crying and, like, begging off from Danielson.
Yes.
Like this man should look like a world killer and have, at, like, you know, at 41 or whatever.
And that's why MJF is scared, and that's why he's continuing to get these assassins. Yeah. I think that'll do it for Shake Them Ropes. You can follow me on Twitter, because I'm still there, at CrapGame13, and just follow the show at Shake Them Ropes. That account updates every time we release an episode. Chris is over on the gram doing at Doctor, the word Doctor _Nove, vanity music plugs and, you know, flooring and cats and things like that.
I'm proud of my flooring. I'm proud of my cats. Proud of my music. It's a proud account, and you can follow me on Twitter at Disco Inferno.
I do another show called The Dynamite Show. It records about 10 minutes after Dynamite goes off the air and uploads about an hour and a half after it goes off the air. We're over at Fight Game Media, patreon.com/fightgamemedia. $5 a month gets you all the shows over there. And we are part of the Voices of Wrestling Broadcasting Network. Shows for every single kind of niche fandom in wrestling. If you're a fan of music of the mat with our friend Andrew Rich, the flagship, of course, with Joe and Rich. And we got a lot of Riches in here. And yeah. And of course, things like Open the Voice Gate, Days of Thunder, covering the WCW Thunder Days, et cetera, et cetera. Encourage all of you to give them a listen on all your podcasting networks everywhere. Chris also has ways to make money in a side hustle. He's going to tell you about them now.
Yeah, you want to like learn guitar or bass or drums? Do you? Well, you can. I can teach you. You can go into the Instagram, Dr. D-O-C-T-O-R _ N-O-V. And I'll teach you how to play music. You too can play guitar.
Is that it?
That's it. That's all I got. That's, you know, what else? What we say?
We'll see you next week.
Hola, hola. My name is Ricardo. I am the host of the Lucha Jobbers podcast here in the Voices of Wrestling podcast network. We are a Spanish-speaking show dedicated to discussing and analyzing pro wrestling from all across the world. From AEW to CMLL, we talk about American wrestling, Japanese wrestling, and of course, Lucha Libre. If something big happened in the pro wrestling world, we will talk about it. So if you know Spanish or have a friend that knows Spanish or want to practice your Lucha Libre pronunciations, go listen to the Lucha Jobbers podcast right here in the Voices of Wrestling podcast network. Nos vemos por ahí.